The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thank you for joining me tonight. My first guest will be Abby Maxman, the president and CEO of Oxfam America. Now, many listeners will recall the story from earlier this year where some individuals who work for Oxfam, which is headquartered in the UK, were accused of sexual misconduct in Haiti back in 2011. We'll talk to her about the impact that had on the organization, what actions Oxfam has taken as a result, and also how the international development community is responding to this crisis.
The pledge, which 118 CEOs have signed, is, I believe, a first step.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an important one because issues of preventing sexual exploitation and abuse have been longstanding. I have worked in post-genocide Rwanda. I have led humanitarian response in Haiti and Ethiopia. These are issues that others in the UN and in the sector have dealt with for a long time and require continued attention.
And then I'll speak with Louise Langheyer, the co-founder and CEO of the Peer Health Exchange, who describes their mission this way.
So Peer Health Exchange's mission is to empower young people with the knowledge, skills, and resources they need to make healthy decisions. And we do that by training college students to teach a skills-based health curriculum in under-resourced public high schools across the country.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, June 10th. Workforces that donate and volunteer together stay together, according to a new report by Benevity. The study shows that workplace turnover is reduced 57% when employees volunteer and give as compared to when they engage in neither activity. Most Americans believe activities that bring together children, youth, and older adults can reduce loneliness across all ages, a report from Generations United and the Eisner Foundation finds. The report states that 92% of Americans want activities that bring all ages together, but only 26% of people are aware of any intergenerational shared sites in their own communities. Most Americans say NASA should focus on Earth, not Mars. A new Pew study suggests that monitoring the climate and killer asteroids rank far higher than going to Mars or the moon. Those sentiments are generally shared across party lines. And finally, Hawaii just passed a law to make their state carbon neutral by 2045. The plan is the most ambitious emissions reduction and renewable energy plan of any state in the country. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Abby Maxman of Oxfam America right after this.
I used to have more hair. I used to have more color. And I used to have cancer. I beat it. I did. Not alone. I used to have no idea what the American Cancer Society did. Research, yeah, but also free rides to chemo and free lodging near hospitals. I used to maybe give a little, then I got so much back. I used to have cancer.
Please give at cancer.org.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting benetech.org.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on to 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
Welcome back to The Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
One of the questions I ask of my guests during the lightning round on The Business of Giving is, what is something you believe that other people think is just insane? Well, if that guest was a nonprofit organization, Oxfam, the answer very well might be, I believe that poverty and powerlessness are avoidable and can be eradicated by human action and political will. And tonight, we will be discussing that and much more with Abby Maxman, the president and CEO of Oxfam America. Good evening, Abby, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thanks, Denver. Good to be here.
Give us a little bit of the history of Oxfam and what the mission of the organization is.
Oxfam was founded in 1942 in Oxford, England, as the Oxfam Committee for Famine Relief, giving humanitarian response to those in occupied Greece. And over the years, as Europe recovered, Oxfam continued to widen its reach around the world to end poverty and ultimately the injustice of poverty. Here in the U.S., we were established in the 70s in response to the independence war in Bangladesh,
right,
and later in Cambodia in the later 70s, which really gave us our role and relevance here in the space and who we are today.
Mm-hmm. What do you believe, Abby, is the unique and distinct value proposition that Oxfam brings to this global enterprise of development and humanitarian aid?
Well, Oxfam looks at issues of poverty through the lens of the injustice of poverty. As you said at the beginning, we believe that poverty is a result of human action and inaction, and
mm-hmm.
we have the ability that has been shown to change that. One in three people live in poverty, and that's both unacceptable and within our reach to change.
Mm-hmm.
Our approach is a multi-strand approach where we do save lives in disaster. We also speak truth to power because of the policy issues and structural issues that keep people poor. And we help people build better futures for themselves over the long term.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're involved in so many different things. Let's touch on a couple if we can. There are now about 60 million refugees and displaced people in the world, and half of those are children. I don't think we've had this many refugees and displaced people since World War II. And I know how deeply committed you are to that issue. Is the global community getting any closer to addressing this crisis in a thoughtful and effective way than they were perhaps a year or so ago?
Well, you raise important issues. There are more than 65 million people displaced by persecution, conflict, and hopelessness. And people don't want to leave their homes.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. And so as a community, globally and nationally here in the U.S., we have opportunity and a responsibility to help those in the places so that those issues that are driving them out can end, such as conflict in some places around the world. But we also, in terms of refugee resettlement here in the U.S., for example, have slammed the door on refugees in the past year. For example, since January through mid-May, the U.S. has allowed exactly 11 Syrian refugees into this country. And compared to last year, which was over 2,000 by this time, we've reduced the number of refugees welcomed to the country from 75,000 to 45,000 at a time when this administration is also challenging humanitarian assistance. We have to step up in the world and really do what we can with the big power that the U.S. has to end some of the conflicts in Syria, in Yemen, and also help people in times of need.
Do you see anything changing with this administration in that regard?
It's concerning what's been happening. Even in terms of refugee resettlement, and actually the door seems to be slamming tighter and tighter.
Mm-hmm.
The bureaucratic red tape for refugees who are seeking asylum is getting harder and harder. We are hopeful in some bipartisan signs in reaching out and having legislation that holds the war in Yemen and the Saudis accountable for bringing peace and some conditionalities to the U.S.'s assistance to the Saudi government in the Yemeni's conflict, for example.
Yeah. I know Oxfam believes deeply in trying to find lasting solutions, and that almost always requires systems change, which is never easy. One area where you're working to do that is in reforming the food system. What needs to be reformed, and what are you doing about it?
Well, the food system is a big issue, and this is one of those areas, Denver, that is, again, within our control as humanity. We know that this world, the planet, has the ability to feed more than the current global population, yet more than 800 million people, as you said, more than half children go to bed hungry every night.
That's right.
It is completely possible to change. So what we're doing, and we believe in this multi-tiered approach, is helping work on the ground with small-scale farmers and small-scale landowners to help them in looking at sustainable production practices. At the same time, we look at some of the bigger issues and the supply chain and global companies, and we both influence and campaign against companies at times and also support them and partner with them to help them do better, whether it's in the poultry industry or other of the big supply chains around food.
Mm-hmm. You're also committed to changing the nature of emergency response. And goodness knows we've had enough emergencies of late. How can you make them, or we make them, more effective?
Well, there's so much learning over the decades, Denver, of what works well in terms of preparedness and response. And local humanitarian leadership and response is fundamental to effective, timely response and life-saving work when disaster strikes, and also in the long-term sustainable improvements after the crisis and the media cycle passes. So we advocate and work on the ground locally in many places, be it in South Sudan and in Puerto Rico and elsewhere, while also looking at the policy changes around that. This has been a topic for years in the system, and there's been pledges made in the World Humanitarian Summit in 2015 to look at local humanitarian leadership and support it and ensure revenues go to investing in that effort. That's very important to us, and we know that it has real impact.
The places in which poverty flourishes, Abby, also happen to be the very same places where the rights of women do not. And Oxfam is working around the world to change that. Tell us some of the things you have been doing in this arena.
Well, fundamental to everything we do is looking at issues of gender and power. These are interrelated, and those voices we are hearing in how decisions are made at the community and household level and those who we are not and now and how. So issues of inclusion and exclusion is very important, be it in our water and sanitation responses, in our food systems work, hearing the voices and bringing in women in decision-making that affects all communities is absolutely fundamental. When our extractive industries work, where we are holding extractive companies to account, ensuring that women's voices are heard with men's and free prior informed consent, that's all fundamental to ensuring that profits go to the communities for required social services to make their lives better. We work to end violence against women and girls, but fundamentally, we should be looking at doing gender and power analysis in everything we do.
Absolutely. Oxfam has been out front and outspoken on the situation in Puerto Rico in the wake of Hurricane Maria. What is your assessment of the relief efforts on the island, and what are some of the things that Oxfam has been doing to help the Puerto Rican people?
Well, we responded in October to the, as part of the response, shortly after the Hurricane Maria hit. And it was very unusual for us to do a domestic response. It was the second time in our history that we responded in the United States. We believe that the U.S. government, as one of the wealthiest in the world, has both the ability and the responsibility to respond to disaster of its people and its citizens. We were appalled and disheartened at the inadequate response back then and took the decision to respond there, providing water and water filters to those who needed it immediately after the response, also solar lights and lanterns to help people because the power grid, which is something that still isn't completely fixed, left millions of people in the dark, and providing legal services to people as they were trying, without power, without internet connections, to make their required online applications to FEMA to have their houses rebuilt and to deal with the damage. And above all, or concurrently, advocacy with the U.S. government to assure a timely and adequately supported response. What we're very concerned about now, Denver, is here we are weeks away from the new hurricane season. 70,000 people in Puerto Rico still do not have power. And the Army Corps of Engineers have been sent back.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a signal. There seems to be a fundamental lack of care and worse with the 3 million citizens of these United States in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
And we believe more can and should be done.
And would I be correct in assuming that they're not that much better prepared for this hurricane season than they were last?
Well, our whole intervention with our local partners who have been wonderful and heroic has been to build back better. We believe that the sign of the power grid is one example. We have concerns about whether the investment has really reached all the places it needs to, and we know that it has been an underfunded response.
Well, earlier this year, Abby, some individuals who work for Oxfam were accused of sexual misconduct in Haiti back in 2011, a story that rocked Oxfam as well as the sector. And it should be noted that Oxfam is certainly not alone in this or other international aid groups that were implicated as well. Tell us the impact that had on the organization and how it has responded to it.
As you say, it really was something that rocked not just Oxfam, but the sector as a whole. We, of course, were deeply disheartened to uncover what happened in 2011. However, at the same time, there was a lot of work in 2011 to take corrective action, investigations, disclosing to various authorities. What we have done, and it's fundamental because we believe these issues are about gender and power,
mm-hmm.
and these are societal issues as well as sectoral issues. And if Oxfam's voice and experience can help share our learnings and our experience to make things better for social change and social good, we are committed to that. This is a priority to safeguard our staff, the people we serve, and to look and assure we're looking at gender and power dynamics and relationships in all we do in the workplace and in the front lines of our work.
Mm-hmm.
So we are investing significantly in ensuring harmonized global policies, practices, and also looking at the internal culture, understanding what happened then that enabled that to happen. We've commissioned an independent commission of women's rights and other leaders who are looking at our policies, practices, culture, and systems back at 2011, re-looking at things we investigated so that we can take those learnings for ourselves and share them with others.
You know, speaking of those learnings, I mean, how do you change a corporate culture? I mean, you have, 10,000 employees or something like that? We know how difficult it is. How do you hope to actually effectuate that change?
Well, Denver, in a couple important areas. One is with continuous looking and alignment with our values,
mm-hmm.
really internalizing our values of empowerment, a commitment, accountability, and inclusion. What do those mean, and how do we model behaviors consistent with those in everything we do as leaders, as staff, and with partners and communities? So that work on culture is ongoing. At the same time, when you look at us structurally and organizationally, we had already made some big changes
mm-hmm.
since 2011. We worked in a very dispersed way in places like Haiti. We made huge organizational changes even as early as 2012, 2013, in how we work in a unified Oxfam, one Oxfam confederation, to have more consistent policies, practices, approaches. We're strengthening our enabling environment for people to come forward.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean? Again, the power dynamics. How do we create the space for communities, for staff, when there's power dynamics going on, for them to come forward, to be aware of how they can bring issues forward, and to ensure that the due diligence and victim-sensitive approaches are embedded in who we are and what we do.
That's great. And looking at this from a broader perspective, you're also the co-chair of a group that was created by Interaction, which is an alliance of international NGOs here in the United States to address this issue. What are these development organizations committed to doing?
Well, as a community, back in December, before the Oxfam issues of 2011 came to the attention. We had already been working on this with interaction in our community. This is an important issue for me personally and professionally, and it's important for Oxfam globally. And so we convened other CEOs in the sector and said, what can we do to bring more attention and capacity for better approaches to protecting staff, communities, and ensuring policies and systems are in place? So the pledge, which 118 CEOs have signed, is, I believe, a first step.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an important one because issues of preventing sexual exploitation and abuse have been longstanding. I have worked in post-genocide Rwanda. I have led humanitarian response in Haiti and Ethiopia. These are issues that others in the UN and in the sector have dealt with for a long time and require continued attention. So the mobilization of a large group of NGOs in the U.S. has real muscle, and we believe it can influence good practice in keeping attention on these issues over time.
Speaking of mobilization, Oxfam has very creative ideas in helping bring attention to a cause, and one of my favorites was the famine food truck. Tell us about that.
Well, the famine food truck was a wonderful effort back in the fall of last year to have a truck in D.C. That was empty. To really bring exposure and highlight an awareness to people about the issues of hunger and famine that we can control,
mm-hmm.
and that we do have the power. Everybody can do something about it. So we do stunts and campaigns to help educate and bring knowledge to people and awareness so that everybody can see how they can get involved.
Well, it caught my attention, so it was successful, at least as far as that is concerned. What's your business model for Oxfam, both here in the U.S. and internationally? What are your sources of revenue?
Well, Oxfam has a position in the U.S. where we historically, in our roots when we were founded in the 70s, we wanted to assure that our actions or our efforts were independent
mm-hmm.
of U.S. government funding and of companies who we might be campaigning against. So our business model requires us to raise funds from individuals, foundations, and other institutions, and it requires us to invest in fundraising along the way, supporter engagement, bringing awareness to these issues. So we believe that this independent voice has made us uniquely positioned to advocate with the U.S. government, with companies, to hold them accountable. In the U.S. government, we are huge proponents of development aid,
mm-hmm.
and our peers look to us to be able to speak truth to power on a consistent basis to influence good policy and practice.
Not beholden to anyone. You have had a very interesting personal journey, Abby, on your way to becoming the president and CEO of Oxfam America. Share it with our listeners, if you would.
Well, I feel very privileged to have my work be my cause. I've been very motivated by these issues. I became aware of the Ethiopian famine in 1984 mm-hmm. when I was graduating high school. And it really struck me. I couldn't understand at the time how this was happening. And it led me eventually to be a Peace Corps volunteer working in Lesotho mm-hmm. in the late 80s when Nelson Mandela was still in jail and apartheid was still the law of South Africa. HIV/AIDS was only beginning to be understood and killing and stigmatizing millions of people. So that led me on this journey. I've worked in post-genocide Rwanda, Haiti, Ethiopia, the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, and many other places. And over these years, and ultimately to Geneva before joining Oxfam,
mm-hmm.
I was involved in operations and helping people at the community level and meeting incredible, resilient women and men and children who pick themselves up from the most unimaginable conditions and with their incredible inspiration and optimism. And it has really inspired me and to both work with them. Oxfam's approach of helping people on the ground build better futures for themselves, save lives in disaster, remain incredibly important. But what really led me to Oxfam was the advocacy and policy influencing that gets at the systemic issues and brings them to scale.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes a lot of social entrepreneurs want to do things the way they want to do them and stay away from government. But you have to get government involved if you're really going to have the kind of impact you want. Well, let's close on that optimistic note, which takes us right back to our opening, which is the belief that Oxfam has that poverty and powerlessness are avoidable. During these difficult and challenging times, what gives you the greatest source of this hope and optimism about the future?
Well, all the incredible people I met. When I was in the slums of Nairobi, the Korogocho slum, last fall, I met a woman named Beatrice who was holding her local authorities accountable for taxes that she and her neighbors were paying to ensure that a local clinic was functioning and running. And she, against all odds, in a place that could be a threat to her own life and livelihood, was bringing voice and holding those in power to account. People like Beatrice give me the inspiration, and I know, and I've seen over the years, over continents and countries, that every person counts, every person matters, and we have the opportunity to help and help people realize their own aspirations.
You know, there's some remarkable people out there who are both tough and resilient in the very best sense of the word. Well, Abby Maxman, the President and CEO of Oxfam America, want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website, maybe something that listeners would find of a particular interest there, and also how they can become engaged and support the organization if they're so inclined.
Thank you, Denver. Please go look at our website, www.oxfamamerica.org. You will find our Take Action page where you will get information and be able to see how you can get involved, whether it's talking to your friends and families about the issues that matter most, calling your local lawmakers and legislators. Your voice matters. Being active, getting out to vote on issues that keep you, that we know of common cause, that keep you motivated and are important to us. And you can donate to Oxfam.
There you go. Well, thanks, Abby. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Denver. Appreciate being here.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org. You probably know Sesame Street as the TV show that taught you letters and numbers, but Sesame is so much more. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit with a mission to help all children grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. Big Bird wants to help, so he started the Yellow Feather Fund to bring education to children in need. You can help too. Visit yellowfeatherfund.org to learn more or make a donation. That's yellowfeatherfund.org. Do you know someone who's dealing with a serious illness or injury? Researchers at Kessler Foundation in West Orange, New Jersey, are studying new treatments for people with brain injury, breast cancer, multiple sclerosis, osteoarthritis, and spinal cord injury. They need volunteers with these conditions, as well as healthy volunteers to serve as controls. To learn more, call Kessler Foundation at 844-KF-STUDY. That's 844-KF-STUDY. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
For many listeners, health and sex ed classes at school could have been better. Someone about the age of your parent telling you what you should and should not do with your body. Despite those limitations, they did impart some valuable information. But now, in many schools, because of budget and staff cuts, as well as increased focus on standardized testing, they don't exist at all. That is where the Peer Health Exchange comes in, bringing these classes back, especially in low-income neighborhoods, and in a way that adolescents can much better relate to. And it's a pleasure to have with us tonight co-founder and CEO of the Peer Health Exchange, Louise Langhier. Good evening, Louise, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you.
Before we dig in to how you do what you do, Give us a brief overview of the organization and of its mission.
So Peer Health Exchange's mission is to empower young people with the knowledge, skills, and resources they need to make healthy decisions. And we do that by training college students to teach a skills-based health curriculum in under-resourced public high schools across the country. We have, since our start in 2003, trained a total of 10,000 college student volunteers to reach 150,000 ninth graders across the country.
Quite impressive. Well, you were up at Yale, Louise, in New Haven, around the turn of the century, when you started what was to become the Peer Health Exchange. Tell us about how this all began.
Well, first of all, it actually did not begin with me, importantly.
Right.
It began with a teacher in a New Haven public school, Tom Shagrew, who had a bunch of Yale volunteers actually tutoring in his classrooms in 1999 when I arrived at Yale as a freshman. And eager as I was to get into the schools and to specifically work on HIV, since I had grown up amidst the HIV epidemic in San Francisco and been affected by it, this teacher sat a group of us down in the fall of 1999 and told us, all you Yale kids who come in here and try to tutor my students, you're actually not very good at it. You don't really know how to teach. And honestly, we have a much bigger need, which is that we've lost our funding for health education, and my students are not getting basic tools about key health issues and decisions they make on sex, relationships, mental health, drugs. And I'm 60, and they definitely do not want to talk to me about these issues. But you all, if you get a diverse group of students in here, you are close enough in age that I think they might really listen to you. And I'm pretty sure you'll be better at that than you are at tutoring. So stop the tutoring and start teaching health. So that was the beginning. There were six of us who started teaching in Tom's classroom in the fall of 1999 and really saw quickly the magic of what he had conceived of, which is that college students, in particular, diverse college students, could, and we did, really relate to ninth graders who looked up to us with enough respect to listen, but enough connection to feel like they could talk to us about these issues.
And that is the founding story. Well, we all know, at least assume, that adolescents do engage in risky and harmful behavior. But what are some of the statistics connected with that behavior, starting with sexual health?
So in sexual health, you're absolutely right that risky behavior is normal to some extent in adolescence. It's part of the experimentation that adolescents go through. For listeners who have any knowledge of one of the adolescent health experts in our field is this incredible woman in New York, Angela Diaz, who runs the Mount Sinai Adolescent Health Center. She often will say, we forget that adolescents are going through a very normal period of experimentation and testing their limits and developing their prefrontal cortex. That said, given that they're going through those tests, the key is that they actually know how to protect themselves and be healthy when they do. So the statistic in sexual health that I like to share that's really important and concerning is that 2 in 5 adolescents did not use a condom the last time they had sex. So the important takeaway from that is, of course, that if young people are not using protection when they have sex, they are much more likely to have an unintended pregnancy. And the data related to unintended pregnancy is perhaps in many ways the most concerning of all, which is that if a young person gets an unintended pregnancy, they have a 70% increased risk of dropping out of high school, of giving birth to an unhealthy child, and of living in poverty for the rest of their life.
Wow. Yeah, we had Mark Edwards of Upstream USA on the show a few weeks ago, and it's amazing that almost half the pregnancies in this country, whether it be young people or others, are unintended pregnancies and tremendous consequences with all of that. Then we have substance abuse. What do the numbers look like there?
Yeah. So in substance abuse, one of the most striking numbers I think to focus on is that 1 in 4 young people is a binge drinker. Oh. And that, you know, has many consequences, one of which is that if a young person is binge drinking, they're much more likely to be the victim or the perpetrator of a sexual assault. So we've all been focused a lot in this country this year on consent and sexual assault. And I think we often don't make the connection between substance misuse and sexual assault that we really need to. Of course, there are also consequences around their ability with an impaired brain and judgment to make decisions that protect their life. I mean, literally, young people die more often in car accidents and otherwise when they've been binge drinking. So that's a really concerning piece of the substance misuse problem.
And another thing we've been concerned about in this country this past year in particular has been mental health. How are American teenagers feeling these days?
Yeah, so the data on mental health is really trending to show more issues for young people with mental health than ever. And one data point on that is that 1 in 5 young people reports that in the last year they felt consistently sad or hopeless, which is just so heartbreaking on many levels. And I think what's particularly important about that data point is that actually for young people who are feeling sad or hopeless or anxious, in many ways, the most important solution is to go get help sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, about 70% of young people who are struggling with mental health never get treatment of any kind, be that talking to a counselor or getting some kind of, drug that they can use to help get them through that. Obviously, often counseling does the trick. But this is all to say that actually it's not mental health can be quite complicated. It can also be quite simple. And so the fact that we have 70% of young people struggling with mental health not getting help just means there's some pretty low hanging fruit on what we could do about that.
Yeah. Listening to those statistics, let me ask you this. When cuts need to be made in school programs, because of budgetary concerns, we almost automatically assume things like health education and gym and the arts are going to be the first to go. What do you think it says about our public education system that these kinds of programs are the ones that are always eliminated?
Yeah, what's so interesting and critical about that is that we have, like you said, we sort of come to expect that schools really exist for the purpose of academics and that the sort of whole child that goes to school and exists in the world has really become way less of our focus in schools. And in many ways, that's actually quite counter to how public schools started in this country. Public schools were really, in the beginning, there to create the sort of civic fabric of society and to create healthy, knowledgeable citizens more than anything else. So there's a long history in this country of public education actually being bigger than academics or more than academics. And it even used to be true that in the government, the Department of Education and the Department of Health and Labor were one.
Mm-hmm.
So there was less distinction between sort of the singular purpose of education as academics and the singular purpose of health as medicine. So I think what it says about our education system is that we have really come to limit what schools can do for young people when actually if I look at where I see the most magical things happening in schools, it's actually true that schools are incredible places. Schools are places where young people can be truly developed into their whole citizen selves. And when you see that happening in the best case examples, it is a holistic approach. It is definitely academics. You need to learn how to read. You need to learn how to do math.
Mm-hmm.
But it also includes the social, emotional, health, well-being, and civic engagement of that child. And the magic of that in the best case scenario means that a young person leaves school and is really ready to contribute to society on all levels, not just because they're healthy, but also because they have kind of the skills to engage as a citizen, to vote, to be a participating member of their community. And I think if we limit ourselves to the academic focus, we will really limit what we can get from the incredibly talented young people that are in our schools. So, I mean, to me, it's really sad. It's also, though, a true testament to the possibility of change, because if we can actually get schools to go back to a day or go forward to a day where they do more holistic education of young people, you can just imagine what that means for our country.
Are you hopeful?
I am. I think so. It might be foolish of me to be hopeful, but after so many years of seeing these cuts, but I do think what's changing in this country in the education system is a real appreciation that, look, academics enough has not worked.
Mm-hmm.
Academics alone has not worked, in that we are still seeing pretty horrible results from schools just from the number of young people who even make it through school, especially in under-resourced communities. And so I think there's starting to be much more focus on the other factors that affect young people. And I think, there are a lot of great organizations and people that are starting to demonstrate what it looks like when you do serve the whole child.
Mm-hmm. Right. You have to get the community involved.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand what their home life is like. You have to get transportation so they can get to school. They have to be nourished.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. People are beginning to look at it in a much more comprehensive way. Well, speaking about those schools, what's the process you undertake to partner with one?
Yeah, great. So we've our process has evolved a lot since we started, but it sort of sticks with the root story of PHE in the sense that we were started by a teacher in a school, and we just always deeply, deeply believe and respect that we need to be partnered with schools and with the partnerships that around that school that really enable it to thrive. And so we start by, when we're in a community, really going individually to schools to assess what their need is and ask them if in that context they can see an opportunity for peer health exchange to help meet that need. We partner with schools that are serving a majority of students at or below the poverty line because these issues specifically around health education and the health and well-being of young people disproportionately affect young people who are young people of color and other marginalized identities who just lack the same resources that their more affluent peers have. And so we start with that criteria, and once we've selected for schools that meet it, we then meet individually with principals and then in turn with teachers in the school to find the period of time during the school day in which we could teach. And our program is not an after-school program. It's not an elective. It's a required class, which is pretty important for reaching the young people where they are. And we teach in ninth grade. So we have to have the school ready to commit a ninth grade class, like an advisory class, once a week for 13 weeks to Peer Health Exchange. And now, increasingly, we also have asked schools to share the cost of the program with us because we really believe in the sort of spirit of what public education could be, that this should be, health education should be core to what a school delivers for young people and to sustain not just our own program, but the kind of broader vision of health education in this country. We want schools to contribute. So that's sort of the process.
Have a little skin in the game.
It really does. Well, it holds us accountable too, right? We've got to deliver.
Invested. You mentioned ninth grade. Why ninth grade?
Yeah. So ninth grade, we thought a lot about this and tested it too, and we'll need to continue to think about it. Ninth grade was where we started originally, and it was really the brilliance of this founding teacher almost 20 years ago in New Haven, because he said, look, you want to get students who are coming in to high school, who are facing these risks at a greater proportion than ever because they're exposed to older kids who are inherently risky because they, whether they're trying to influence younger kids to try substances or influence younger kids to get into relationships with them, these older kids have a sort of disproportionate influence. So the ninth grade is really the moment when the sort of most risky behavior can occur because they're still so young and still so sort of moldable, but they're really exposed to a lot of the older kids' stuff. And, you know, they're sort of ready to learn at the same time. They're still in school, which is sadly for a lot of the students that we serve. By the end of ninth grade, the dropout rate increases.
Yeah, that's right.
So you really want to reach them while they're there. Thought about eighth grade. We tested our model in seventh and eighth grade because a lot of these behaviors are happening younger and younger. But ultimately, what we saw in our evaluation was that ninth grade was the place we could have the greatest impact the fastest. Seventh and eighth grade, our results were decent. We had increased knowledge in some ways and increased skills in others, but we saw less what's called help-seeking behavior, where students were actually going to get help for mental health or sexual health. And we decided that at least for now, though the dream would be one day, you know, children get health education at every grade level, if we're going to pick one, ninth grade is the year where we can have the greatest impact.
Well, it's a year where there's a lot of transition. You get out of middle school and you're going to high school and there's a lot of influences. And as you say, it's probably really the last chance you have to capture these kids before they become, if I dare say, too cool to do all this. Well, you have a school now that you're partnering with. So you begin to recruit college students from surrounding universities, and you certainly don't accept everyone who applies. How does that unfold, and who are some of the colleges that you're currently partnering with?
Yeah, so our college student process, you know, is really so much the secret sauce of what Peer Health Exchange does, and it's really because college students, especially a really diverse group of college students, have an unbelievable ability to both be a part of and commit to doing this work, but also to, as we said earlier, to relate to young people. Mm-hmm. So we really value every step of this process quite a bit. We do start with recruiting college students. We want more applicants than available spots, so we can be selective, mostly because we want to select for a true commitment to the mission and the vision of PHE, and then the time commitment and process it takes to become a health educator. And we do have at least two applicants for every spot on campus. Importantly, in that process, we're really recruiting for a diverse group of volunteers. So we found over over time while I was a white woman starting this program with a group of largely other white women, that actually there were real limits on how much impact a group of white women could have mm-hmm. on young people, in particular young people of color, and that it was much more powerful to have a mix of not just folks who looked like me, but also young people who were really sharing the backgrounds of the young people that they were serving and brought just more talent inherent in that diversity.
Yeah,
and
so much more relatable to the students.
Yeah. And so we've really expanded the recruitment specifically from, you know, the original colleges. I'll just use New York as an example because we're here. Our original colleges in New York were Barnard, Columbia, and NYU. And while they're still really amazing programs at those three colleges and definitely have more diversity in those programs, we actually started recruiting more and more in the last 5 years from City University of New York, CUNY, mm-hmm. the one and only, and from specifically Hunter College, Brooklyn College, York College, Queens College, City College. And that has been a really powerful process in for us, getting a more talented, more diverse group of young people. So there are 500 volunteers this year alone who are health educators for Peer Health Exchange in New York City, and about half of those volunteers are CUNY mm-hmm. college students. 75% of CUNY students went to New York City Public High School, so right. there's just more of a connection. Anyway, once they're selected, they then are trained rigorously. This is not your average volunteer program where you just sort of show up for obvious reasons because you can't do that and teach about these sensitive health topics, but they're trained really in cultural competence. So to sort of bring everyone to the same equity core value we hold so dear, we do a power, privilege, and oppression training to ensure that no matter where college students are coming from, they can all kind of get on the same page about what it means to do this work with young people in community. They do work on classroom management, on public speaking, and ultimately on trauma-informed approach in the classroom. They're assessed essentially on their skills before mm-hmm. they're allowed to teach, and that's pretty important. So it's not really like checking the box on training either. You sort of have to demonstrate you've gotten sure. what you were taught, and then you start teaching usually about 2 months later, 20 hours and 2 months later.
Okay.
You start mm-hmm. teaching in the classroom with another college student volunteer. Mm-hmm. And if you're a high school student, you get those two college students and now have the same two college students show up every week for 13 weeks teaching you the curriculum.
Mm-hmm. And what's in that curriculum? Aside from some of those things, what is the core thing? I mean, I think you have 13 modules or thing, something.
Yep.
Yeah. What are some of those?
So the core of the curriculum is really a skills, set of skills that the college students practice with young people that are applied to the three health topics that we focus on the most. So the skills are reflection, communication, decision making, and accessing resources.
Oh, wow. So you can really activate this knowledge, in other words.
Exactly. I mean, what we learned over in the beginning is that knowledge is just not enough. I mean, I can tell you because I used to teach problematically way too much about knowledge.
Yeah.
It's just not enough. And it's really not what young people lack. I mean, there are definitely myths about, you know, how one gets pregnant or how, you know, you can – what might happen to you if you get caught or with a substance or, you know, what might happen if you're struggling with mental health. There are myths about those topics. But more importantly, that young people just actually don't know how to have conversations about these issues with peers and partners, what to do if they do need help. And so it's really the practice of those skills. Like, literally, someone – in a situation is pressuring you to use a substance or someone is pressuring you to have unwanted sex, how do you have that conversation? Practice.
Yeah.
That's what it looks
role
like,
play.
Which is really,
really
helpful. And, mm-hmm. and then it's applied to sexual health, mental health, and substances.
I'd also imagine that a lot of these young people don't know where health services are or have the knowledge and wherewithal on how to access them.
Yeah, so we've learned over time that this is sort of one of the most simple and powerful ways to help young people on these issues is exactly what you said. So there are actually a ton of really great health resources mm-hmm. out there for young people, especially in New York City, whether that's the Mount Sinai Adolescent Health Center or school-based health clinics. There are lots of resources actually in most of our communities. 40% of the public schools we serve have a school-based health center in the building.
Mm.
But as we learned when a couple years ago we took a tour of the Washington Irving campus where we do work, and there's a school-based health center, and we were asking students where the school-based health center was to go find it. They don't even know that it's there half the time, let alone where it is. And they're just highly underutilized. And so, yeah, there's this really sort of low-hanging fruit with young people, which is like take them on a tour of the mm-hmm. health center, show them that it exists, that the people who work there are generally really nice
and friendly,
and that mm-hmm. you won't get, you know, a sort of big sign on your head if you go, so the stigma gets removed, and that they're free and confidential services. So that is a big part of what it takes to get people to actually go get help.
I bet it does. You have done an external evaluation of the work that you do. It was conducted by the American Institutes of Research. You want to find out what's working and what's not working so well. What did you learn?
Oh, we learned so much. So, yeah, we about now, I guess, 7 years ago, we really stepped back from our growth. We had been growing from basically 2004 to 2011, kind of every year. And really, we had been focused on filling the gap for health education. Where there was no health education or there was very little health education, we were coming in and providing it, kind of based on our founding story. But in 2011, we stepped back, and we'd been doing evaluations since the beginning, mostly because when we were college students, we had no idea what we were doing. So we evaluated to genuinely try to get better and not for anyone else's purposes. But we stepped back and said, you know, the evaluation we've done, it hasn't been super rigorous. It's been pre-post testing. It's taught us some things about what students are learning, but it wasn't with a control group. So we don't really know whether or not our program was the thing that made the difference. And also, it didn't ask all the questions we wanted to ask. And if we really want to actually deliver impact for young people, not just fill the gap, but actually help them make healthier decisions, we need to understand better, like, what are we good at and what are we not good at? Mm-hmm. So we did undertake this pretty massive evaluation with American Institute of Research.
4,000 students?
Yeah. And we did a couple different quasi-experimental control trials, one of our standard program in the ninth grade, and then another of our pilot program with 7th and 8th graders, which I referenced earlier, and then a third one with a follow-on program doing our program plus a booster in 10th grade, and then an exploratory study of our program plus the school-based health center tours. And we also, alongside that, which we call summative and many evaluators call summative evaluation or end outcome focused evaluation, we also did a bunch of formative evaluation, because the reason we were doing the summative was not just to learn what worked and what didn't, but why, so we could make it better. Yeah. So we did a lot of formative assessment, like exit slips from when students and teachers were leaving classrooms, et cetera. And we learned a ton. I would say highlights were that we had significantly more impact on mental health and sexual health than substances. We actually had no positive impact on substances. Thankfully, no negative impact either, okay, which is not to be taken for granted.
But that's eye-opening.
But it was eye-opening, and it really taught us, like, whatever we're doing, which, by the way, unfortunately, was consistent with a lot of what's happening in the field, it just isn't showing
results.
These
are the best practices, and they need to get better.
Yeah, and mental health and sexual health were also really helpful to see impact on, in particular on increasing young people's knowledge on things like giving and getting consent, their ability to recognize the warning signs of depression, then their skill to actually give and get consent increased, and their ability to go get help. So one of the kind of biggest outcomes we saw positively was that in our exploratory study with the school-based health center tour, we saw a really significant increase in the number of young people in our program who went to use a school-based health center specifically for mental health and sexual health. So things like going to talk to a trusted adult more, going to talk to a counselor, going to get contraception. Uh-huh. And that was eye-opening for us, too, because we thought, okay, well, first of all, we got to fix the substance abuse stuff and figure out how to actually have an impact on it. And second of all, if we're seeing great results or promising results around mental health and sexual health in particular and getting young people to get help, then that really can show us that our role is to empower young people in the classroom, build these trusting relationships with them and the college students, but also ensure that they're actually getting help when they need it and preventing health problems before they start and being this link to care that kind of simplified and clarified our role.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah. And I think the principals and the college students thought highly as well, right?
Yes, no, definitely. We got some really good feedback from our schools. We did a lot of evaluation on what their experience and levels of satisfaction looked like. And then, yeah, college students as well. And I think in particular with college students, what we saw and have continued to see in evaluations is that this experience with Peer Health Exchange was really sort of the formative experience for them in college in a couple ways. One, for college students, it built community on college campuses. In particular, actually, this is really important for our equity core value. For students who were going to commuter schools and who typically were carrying much bigger loads because they were oftentimes students of color and other marginalized identities who were showing up at college with incredible responsibilities, like, you know, working one to two jobs, maybe having family responsibilities and going to college. That Peer Health Exchange at our best could be for them a real community on campus of like-minded, values-aligned people. And we have, you know, just incredible stories about just that component of literally college students with us who have met all their best friends through Peer Health Exchange, have gotten married to someone from Peer Health, you know, not that that's the purpose, but it's a great part of the value we can provide. The other thing we heard from college students was that it really shaped their careers and helped them get jobs. And I think a lot of that is due to the fact that their experience, if they wanted to become a teacher, you know, this experience really showed them what is it like to teach, and whether that then manifested itself in now, you know, teaching or not teaching. They learned. Yeah. But for those that did want to go into teaching, I mean, what's really compelling to us now is we literally have programs where our college student volunteers, if they apply, are sort of fast-tracked in the application process, like a Teach for America, or even at some of our schools in LA, they're literally charter management organizations that are holding teaching positions for Peer Health Exchange volunteers every year because they just know that they're going to be stronger teachers coming in and that they really are committed. Or on the health front, we've had many more students who've decided to go into public health or decided to go into adolescent medicine and feel that Peer Health Exchange is the thing that both convinced them to do that, but also helped them get into graduate school or get that job, which I think especially for college students today, especially for college students who are sharing the backgrounds of the young people we serve, more and more of whom, by the way, actually got Peer Health Exchange in high school, which is the best possible example. They actually, the amount of barriers they face to getting a job are huge. So anything in college that can help them to actually get the skills they need to get that job.
Give them the edge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that you took a look at that too. Sometimes we spend so much time focusing on the beneficiaries, but it's the people who are actually volunteering that can get as much, if not more, sometimes out of these programs. We mentioned a few moments ago that we were in New York.
Yes, we are.
And you talked about some of the colleges you're working with, and I know you have a pretty significant presence in the city. Tell us a little bit about the schools, the high schools that you're working with.
Yeah, New York City for Peer Health Exchange was really the very first site, and it's still in so many ways the leader of the pack for us in terms of our sites. It's doing incredible work and, you know, has a large presence and deep partnership with schools in New York City. So we, this past year, we had 500 college student volunteers. They served over 5,000 ninth graders in almost 50 high schools in New York in four boroughs. And next year we'll launch for the first time in Staten Island.
There
so we'll
go.
Be in all
I
five boroughs.
The one that you left out.
Yep. I'm really excited to be in deep partnership with Staten Island, who, you know, as I'm sure folks know, has had, among other things, a real problem with the opioid crisis and so has reached out to us about 2 years ago to start conversations about what it would take to bring Peer Health Exchange to Staten Island, in part in that context. So, and we do partner deeply with individual schools, the ones we work with. We also partner deeply with the New York City Department of Education and the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, which of course magically in New York, which is the example for the whole country, share an Office of School Wellness between the two departments, just how it should be. And our New York City Executive Director, Rachel Peters, has great relationships with some of the incredible people that run that office. And they, together with many other partner organizations in New York, have really advocated to the City Council and others to advance health education as not only a requirement, but a funded requirement. And there's been some really exciting progress on that this spring, where City Council just decided to have some additional funding go towards health education across the city of New York. And we are just honored and thrilled to be a small part of that. But it's been really critical to be part of a sort of larger movement in New York City.
Great stuff. What's your business model, your mix of philanthropy? I know we have some earned revenue. You're trying to get these schools to put some skin in the game and maybe some of your key partnerships.
Yeah. So we, for the longest time, we were pretty much entirely philanthropically funded and thankfully have a pretty cost-efficient model because we're training these incredible college students who do this as volunteers. But we have felt in the last few years and have started to change the business model to better reflect the long-term systems change we want to see, in the sense that, like you said, we have started to ask schools to share the cost of the program. And so we'll have this year actually almost $400,000 of our overall revenue coming from public school partners, which represents about 13% of our local operating costs.
Good start.
And a huge testament to these schools, by the way. It's not as though they have a line in the budget for health education. They are coming up with these funds.
They just yanked it.
It's many other demands. So we just have so much respect for the schools that find ways to do this. The other partnerships we have that are not just philanthropic are with health institutions. And that's been really deliberate on our part. Where we've asked our hospital partners and community to contribute to the cost of Peer Health Exchange wherever there's a benefit also to them in their work to extend their reach in the community or to do more evaluation and sort of innovation around what the hospital is doing. So, for example, in New York City, we have a wonderful partnership with the NYU Langone Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, run by Helen Egger, who's just a total visionary and has, with her team, committed to not only helping to fund Peer Health Exchange in New York, but being a real evaluation partner with us. UCSF in San Francisco and Stanford have done that as well. And that's been really critical. So the dream is that over time, these two sources of funding, schools and health systems, will become a bigger part of what our revenue model looks like.
Well, there you go. Well, let me pick up on that, and let me get you out on this, Louise. You have said you have a way of envisioning the future, sometimes in the extreme. The outrageous possibilities for the Peer Health Exchange on one hand, and the worst-case scenarios, just so you can prepare for them, on the other. But taking that former, if everything aligns and falls into place, what do you see the potential for the Peer Health Exchange over the next decade?
So I really believe that the dream for Peer Health Exchange over the next decade would look like all young people in this country getting to have effective health education in school so they are prepared to make healthy decisions in life. And I think the way that we could get there would look like more and more schools actually doing health education in partnership with us and on their own and really owning the responsibility and the ability to deliver that effectively. And the real dream on top of that is that the health partners and community organizations around those schools would see their job going all the way outside the walls of the hospital and into the school to partner with the school to help enable that health education and help enable young people to get to the health resources before there's a problem. And I sort of picture a day where those two systems are not separate. They're really, if you focus on the child, they're really together and they're actually together serving the child where the child needs it most. And that we're not talking in 10 years about the cuts for health education, but instead saying, what schools do for young people is help them become healthy, brilliant citizens that can contribute significantly to society.
A very nice dream that I think we can all buy into. Well, Louise Langeyer, the co-founder and CEO of the Peer Health Exchange, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and how listeners can become engaged and support your work.
Wonderful. Yes. Yeah. So our website is www.peerhealthexchange, PeerHealthExchange.org. And we would love to have you visit us and get engaged in a number of ways, whether you're a young person who wants to bring this program to your college or your high school, a teacher or principal who wants to do the same, a community partner in a hospital or healthcare institution, or a philanthropist who wants to make a donation. It will take every single one of those to make this work happen well. So we hope you will join us.
Great. Well, thanks, Louise. It was a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.
And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you come back next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.